Hi, I'm Luke Dennis, the Development Director at WYSO. We are happy we can deliver these programs to you, people who listen on the web, and we rely on you to help us pay for this service. So at our website, wyso.org, click Support This Station and help keep these services coming. And thank you.
Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome to the program today Ricky Skaggs. Hello, Ricky.
Good to talk to you, Vic. Thanks for having me on.
Ricky, after all these years, you decided to write a book. It's called Kentucky Traveler, My Life and Music. You wrote it with Eddie Dean. What brought you to this point in your life where you decided to look back?
Well, I think it was a good time. I'd been approached by another publisher about 10 years ago to do a book, and I don't think I was quite ready. I'm not sure that you're ever really ready to take on this. I know certainly I thought I was ready even to do this book with HarperCollins, but it's quite an undertaking, and I know 10 years ago, I had just pretty much started the Skaggs Family Records, and I was really busy with a lot of different artists that I had signed on the label and doing road dates and, just being busy, man. And, not that I'm not busy now, but, I felt like I was able to carve out enough time to work on it. Still, I don't. I think this was the hardest thing that I've ever done. Working on it, interviewing with Eddie, him writing it down, typing it up, sending it back to me, and me saying, "Wait a minute, I didn't say that. That's not what I said. That's not what I meant." You know,
uh-huh.
And having to rewrite it myself and send it back to him, and but it took us a while to get into a rhythm and a flow. But the main reason I chose Eddie was because I had read Ralph Stanley's book that Eddie had done, and it sounded just like Ralph talking, and that's what I wanted more than anything. Was I wanted to leave the mountainese, the Kentuckiness, in my voice, because that's how I talk. That's how I've always talked, and I've never gone to broadcast journalism school and learned how to speak the proper English, but I just talk the way I talk, and that's what I wanted left in there, so that people that did know me knew that I, had really written this thing, but yet people that didn't know me would know I was from another part of the planet that they need to visit sometime.
Yeah, that book he did for Ralph, Man of Constant Sorrow.
Yes, sir.
I can see why you decided to work with him on this project, and we've got all these great stories going back to when you're just a boy, and that's when it all started, this lifelong love of music on your part. And I love so many of these stories, the one about how your dad got that mandolin for you. Right here in Southwest Ohio, we're WYSO, we have been playing bluegrass for many, many years on the station. It's a staple. And he got that mandolin for you in Lima, and you woke up one morning and you're 5 years old, and there it was in the bed.
It was. And of all things, I had, I don't know that I'd ever really ask him for one, but I really didn't know the story till later on in my life. But Dad, when I got a little older, Dad told me about a brother that he had. 5 years old, 6 years old, you don't really remember maybe some fireside chats that you may have with your dad. That's a long, long time ago. But later on in my life, he told me about my uncle that played mandolin and sang harmony with my dad. Dad played guitar and sang the lead. And my uncle, Okel Skaggs, O-K-E-L is the spelling of his name, and Okel used to play mandolin and sing harmony with my dad, and they were just the best friends. They ran together, they played together, sang together, and Okel was called into World War II and was killed in Guam you know, and he was actually killed rescuing a buddy that was still on the beach. My uncle went down to try to get him pulled into safety and got killed, and my grandmother and grandfather received a Purple Heart, you know, for his bravery. But I think it devastated my dad. You know, he never quite got over that, and I think he made one of those inner vows that if he ever had a son or daughter that showed musical abilities, that he would get them a mandolin, and hopefully, you know, they'd play and sing, you know, like his brother did. So I guess that's what happened with me. I'd been singing around the house, even at 3 or 4 years old. Mom said I was singing. And so I think they saw that there was some musical abilities there, and so Dad just kind of took it upon himself. One time he found this little half-pint-sized mandolin in a pawn shop there in Lima, and bought it and brought it home and stuck in my bed, you know, and that was the beginning. You know, I remember putting my hands around that little mandolin neck, and, you know, I think about it now, there was such a sense of destiny. Every picture that I've seen, even the front cover picture, if you can really get in there and look at that eyeball looking into the camera, there's a destiny in my eye. There's just an assurance, you know, this is right for me to do this, you know, and even being on the Flat and Scruggs show at 7, when you can see my eyes, you know, as I'm playing the mandolin there on the Flat and Scruggs thing, you can find it on YouTube. That eye is just set, you know, into the camera. Like I'm supposed to be here. This is my place, and I'm taking it, you know. And I've never been shy about playing music. You know, I've not always, you know, as a kid, I didn't always, you know, enjoy playing till midnight. You know, but I guess Dad was getting me used to musician hours. You know, and I certainly didn't like having to get up at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. I realized then that was not musician hours either. But I remember one time we came to Nashville. We were still living in Kentucky, and I remember us going to Nashville one time after maybe we'd played the Ernest Hub Record Shop, and so Dad had us up. You know, I mean, that the Midnight Jamboree, that means midnight. It started at midnight, you know, and so we didn't get in bed till probably 2 o'clock in the morning, 2:30, and Dad had us up at 5 o'clock, you know, getting ready to drive back to Kentucky. And I just remember telling my mom, oh, and I was crying. I said, oh, it sure doesn't it doesn't take long to sleep here in Tennessee. And I think that all the time that I have these early mornings, like at Fox and Friends the other morning, I was doing a sound check and rehearsal with the Tower of Power. I played with those guys up there at five o'clock in the morning. We were supposed to be on set, so that's not my kind of hours.
Yeah. Ricky Skaggs joins us. His memoir, Kentucky Traveler, My Life and Music, officially published today. And these stories that you're telling in here, especially these ones where you go back to being a little kid, sure, you were on that TV show when you were 7 years old, but when it came on the TV, you ran and hid under the bed. You didn't see that thing for 30 years, did you?
I sure didn't. I freaked, you know. you know, it would be television, really, at the time. I mean, it was kind of a new thing for us mountain folks. You know, we could get it a little bit. We had a few channels that we could see, and but it still was a new thing. I didn't understand very well, you know, what all was going on with tape and everything like that. But anyway, we sat down, Mom got the dishes done and supper over with and all that, and so we sat down to watch it, and sit there, and, you know, we watched the first, you know, 10, 12 minutes of Flat and Scruggs, you know, going, playing and doing a song or two and going off to commercial and coming back. And so when it came back and Lester's on the set there and he's talking, and you see me walking out on the set, and I grab him by the coattail, you know, and kind of interrupt him there a little bit as he's talking. That was a hard thing to do, even with my, you know, just knowing my mom was sitting there watching me, because my mother had always told me, you know, you don't ever interrupt a grown-up when they're talking. You know, don't interrupt anybody. And so here, you know, mom didn't get the memo, you know, and I didn't have time to tell her before we started rolling tape, you know, because there she was sitting over there, and I walk out and interrupt this guy, and so I'm thinking of that too. And but being at home on the couch, when I saw myself walk out on the set, I just kind of freaked out, you know, and I ran into my bedroom and got under the bed. Mm-hmm. I didn't put my fingers in my ears though, but I did hide my eyes. I didn't want to see what I was hearing, but I wanted to hear what I was hearing. And I didn't see it for many, many years after that. I actually sat down with my two youngest kids at the time once we found a copy and watched it all together. They couldn't believe that I was ever that young, because I was about their age that they were at the time. You know, and there I was, there their dad was, you know, almost their age. It was a great thing though to see.
I have so many favorite stories in this memoir, and a lot of them go a long way to show just how you went the way you went. You know, there's a time your mom was milking the cow and you shot her with the squirt gun. And,
oh boy!
You know, there's a story about the time your dad drove his Ford Galaxy over your mandolin.
Yeah.
I think one of my all-time favorites, though, is when you go in the record store. You're living in Columbus. I think you're about 14, and money was tight in the family, and you came upon all these old Stanley Brothers albums, and you just had to have them, didn't you?
I did. It was like, this is my books for, you know, for school for the next, you know, 5 years. I've got to learn this stuff. You know, had no idea that I was going to be meeting Keith Whitley. I had no idea I was going to be meeting Ralph Stanley again. I mean, I'd met him and Carter when I was about 9, but I had no idea I was going to be going back to meet them. But there was just destiny there. I remember seeing those albums and looking at titles that I'd never heard before, you know, and Lonesome River, Angels Are Singing in Heaven Tonight, Fields Have Turned Brown, you know, I hadn't even heard of those songs, you know, and my dad would look at him. He said, "Son, I remember him singing that Little Glass of Wine." You know, and I said, "Is that a good one, Dad?" "Oh, that's a dandy, son." And, you know, and he's, "Now that White Dove, oh, that was a big hit for them. I remember hearing them on the radio back on Farm and Fun Time in Bristol when I was, you know." And I thought, "Oh my goodness," you know. And so here I was pulling all these albums out, you know, and it was all Stanley Brothers stuff. It wasn't like I was, you know, trying to get, you know, everybody else's music, but I was really focused on their music. And my dad reached in his billfold underneath a bunch of cards and papers and stuff he had folded up, and he'd put $100 bill in there that was so old looking, you know, and sweaty and everything like that, you know. And he unfolded that $100 bill, and that was his rainy day account, you know, money for an emergency. And I guess he thought this was a rainy day emergency, that it was time to cash in, you know, that money. And but that's the kind of dad I had, you know. And he saw that I was just eat up with this music and really wanted to learn more and more and more, you know. And those records helped me so much. And when I did meet Ralph then again, after Keith and I met, you know, really we met the next year, I guess, is we'd moved back to Kentucky, and I met Keith at 15, and you know, when we started singing together, that's all we were singing was Stanley Brothers songs, because that was one of his very favorite groups too. And but yet I knew a bunch of these old songs that he didn't know, so it was kind of cool to share those records with him and let him learn some of them. And then we met Ralph. Wasn't long, maybe 6 months after Keith and I had met, we met Ralph again in West Virginia
at Jim and Gay's. Now, would you call that a skull orchard, or was it a little nicer?
No, that was definitely that was beer joint, you know, beer joint bluegrass, you know.
Yeah, and, that's my favorite story in the whole book. When you're at Jim and Gay's and Ralph's truck or Ralph's bus broke down, and tell the story. That's my all time favorite in the whole book.
Well, we go there to see this new lead singer that Ralph has, a guy named Roy Lee Centers, and he was an Ohio boy, and he. You know, he just joined Ralph's band, and so, you know, Larry Sparks had just left, and Ralph had hired this new guy, so we just couldn't wait to hear this new singer. Everybody said he sung like Carter, you know, and so We go over to watch him. You know, Dad drives us over there, and Keith's brother Dwight goes with us, Dwight Whitley, and so we're sitting there at this table, and you know, realizing that you know we ain't seen no activity. No, none of the guys are coming in to set up. You know, they had a couple of mics set up on stage, but that's about it. You know, and so this club owner comes up to us and says, "Fellas, we got a phone call from Ralph, and his bus broke down. He's got a flat tire, and he's going to be, you know, maybe an hour late getting here." He said, "You think you boys could get up and sing a few songs while he's getting here?" And so we didn't hesitate. We just looked at each other, and of course, my dad, you know, being the good Boy Scout, always being prepared. You know, actually, he should have got money for the phrase, you know, "Don't leave home without it." You know, so we always had our instruments in our car ready just in case someone ever asked us to play. You know, that was always his way, and so we ran out there and got our instruments and I mean, who would have thought to do that, going to a concert to see somebody? You know, I mean, it's just like, here's these crazy things happen all the time, you know. And so anyway, we run out there and get our stuff, and we go back in this little dressing room and tune up and come out, and this guy introduces us, you know, as Ricky Skaggs and Keith Whitley, you know. And so we walk up there and start singing these songs, and we're singing Stanley Brothers songs. And about 35 minutes into the show, you know, they pull in, and Ralph gets out and walks into the bar, and he doesn't go to his dressing room. He pulls up a bar stool over there, kind of in the dark side of the bar, and he's just sitting there by himself, you know, watching us sing. And it's just like I can see him in my vision, and I'm really wishing that he would not be staring at me. You know, I'm wishing that he would just go on back to the dressing room, you know, and that we really needed to get off his stage and off of his show and all of that. You know, we're so shy and so embarrassed that he comes in and almost like he catches us singing his music, you know. But finally he does go back in the dressing room, and we finish our set, you know, and of course, our instrument cases are back there in his room, and we're just, you know, so embarrassed that we left our instrument cases in the floor and all that, you know. And he said, "Oh, no, boys," said, "it's all right." Said, you boys did a fine job. And Curly Ray said, "You sound just like Ralph and Carter," you know. And Ralph said, "You know, when I pulled in, I thought they was playing the jukebox. Thought they had some old songs of ours on the jukebox." And said, "I walked in and seen you boys singing," and said, I had to sit and watch you, you know." And so he gets up on stage and starts bragging on us and everything, and says, how would you like to hear them boys sing on our set, you know, on our, you know, when we get off and doing our show, how would you like to hear them sing some more? And everybody just applauding, you know. And so, gosh, we felt so privileged and so great. I mean, you know, people talk about defining moments, you know. That was definitely, no doubt about it, a defining moment in our career, because as much as the Bill Monroe story at 6 years old, the Flat and Scruggs thing that happened at seven, those definitely were defining moments for me. But that one with Ralph was a tangible thing, because after that, we just became great friends with Ralph. He invited us back. He said he's going to be playing back there in about 6 weeks and wanted us to come back and do some more music, and we did. And then we played Frontier Ranch with him in Columbus. We went up there and did a show with him as well. And that was the time that he called us out on stage. We actually worked up a couple of songs to do with him. We did Lonesome River and Angels Are Singing in Heaven Tonight. We worked up those songs and went out and did those songs with him, you know, on that stage show. And that's when he really started taking interest in us and saw the crowd response of two young kids wanting to carry on, you know, his music and his legacy, you know. And I think that started a relationship with Ralph that, you know, still goes on even now. You know, I'm so thankful to have had Ralph Stanley in my life.
And you learned, hanging around with Ralph all that time, that initial praise that he gave you that very first night was high praise indeed for a man of few words.
Yeah, it really was, because he, you know, he didn't say much to you. And I think sometimes I might be a little too much like that with my own band, because I've had guys in my band tell me, I mean, as a matter of fact, Andy Liff, which my fiddle player that I absolutely adore, and one of the best musicians on the planet, I think, for this kind of music. And he called another guy that had been in my band for, you know, two different times, but for, you know, probably 10 years, if you count both times that he was with me, Keith Sewell, that's out with Lyle Lovett now, and went out with the Dixie Chicks for quite a long time when they were out playing. Andy and Keith are friends, and Keith called him one day, and he said, Andy called Keith one day, and he said, "Man, I don't know if Ricky really likes my playing or not, you know." He said, "I've been here a pretty good while," and he just smiles at me, you know, and looks at me, and kind of nods his head, you know, but I've never, you know, he's never really set me down and told me anything, like, you know, anything he wants me to change or anything, you know, he wants me to do. And Keith said, "Son, if Ricky is not saying anything, he loves your playing." It's, you know, he'll tell you if he wants you to change something. Uh-huh. You know, he'll tell you. So maybe I learned that lesson too much from Ralph, and it worked with my generation, but I'm not sure that how, you know, these younger kids, they might need a little bit more encouraging, and maybe I need to be a little bit more daddy like to them sometimes, and just be a little more hands-on and in the encouragement realm.
Ricky Skaggs joins us. He's been doing a lot of touring over the years, all those cities, all those nights. But this is the first time he's ever been out touring for his book. He's actually written a memoir after all these years. It's called Kentucky Traveler, My Life in Music. He joins us on the program talking about fiddlers. You got a guy you introduce us to in the book named Sanford Kelly, who was a great fiddler, but you talk about how one time you picked up a banjo and this did something to you, didn't it?
It did. You know, I mean, his fiddle playing definitely, you know, changed my thoughts about music, because I'd never really heard anybody play the old-time mountain style of fiddling before, like Sanford played. He played with these, you know, weird tunings, and he'd tune his E string down and make these really mournful slides, and he'd play majors against minors, or minors against majors, whatever he felt, you know. And it just had this haunting sound, and it was so from the mountains. I mean, this was not city music, okay? This was not this was not even bluegrass, you know. This was pre-bluegrass, many years before, you know. Mm-hmm. But I loved it. I loved what I heard. And so he'd come over to the house once, and Dad set up the tape recorder and we taped a bunch of fiddle stuff. And, well, he came over a second time and brought his fiddle, my dad said, "Sanford, did you bring your banjo with you?" And he said, "No." Said, "I sold it. I ain't even got a banjo anymore." And my dad said, "Son, run under there, run in the bedroom and get that banjo out from under the bed and bring it in here." You know, Dad had bought me a banjo, and I was trying to play some kind of scrug style, you know, and I could play the roll and stuff like that. But you know, I never really felt like I wanted to be a real 5-string banjo player, you know. So I brought it in there, and Sanford took it, and he started tuning on it and tuned the 4th string down and the 2nd string up, and, you know, I never heard a tuning like that before. And then he started playing this clawhammer banjo, and he had this big old wide thumb, you know, that he that he played the, you know, I'd watch him grab the bow and play the fiddle. But he was starting to drop that thumb and play different notes, you know, with the thumb as he's keeping this rhythm on the banjo. And it just, this sound come out of that banjo and absolutely blew my mind. I'd never heard anything like that. It sounded like a computer playing music. It was so perfect and so good, but it was so foreign to my ears. But my heart was going, yeah. I mean, it was like pouring water over parched ground or something like that. And I didn't know I was parched, you know, but it was like this. This was such a drink of water that I needed so desperately. I really wanted to know this, and I wanted to know more about it. And so, you know, I had him. You know, he taped probably 30 or 40 minutes of just banjo stuff. You know, and so he didn't sit down and show me how to do it or anything. I mean, I watched him do it. You know, watched him the way that the sound was, the way that the notes followed, you know, each other. And so I had this rhythm kind of in my brain of how he done it, you know. So I'd sit and listen to the tape, and I would sit with the banjo, and I would try to replay what I had seen in my mind and what I was hearing in my ears, and trying to make it all work together. And finally, one day, I just remember getting the fifth string in the right rhythm, because it falls in a different place than a five string. Earl Scruggs five string roll, the fifth string falls in a different rhythm, you know. Mm-hmm. But once I found that, then I was able to get the rhythm in my mind, and then it was just a matter of learning the notes and all that kind of stuff, and then kind of, you know, getting smooth about with what I was doing. So Sanford Kelly was a major player, you know, in my life musically. I just absolutely could not imagine taking that old-time fiddle away from me and that old-time drop-thumb style banjo, taking that the influence of that out of my music, what it would be. It would be much more shallow. I know that.
Hmm. There are so many wonderful stories in this book. It's Kentucky Traveler, My Life in Music. Ricky Skaggs wrote it, and he's been our guest today on the program. And when you check it out, you can find out about the time that innocent young Ricky offered to clean the banjo for Ralph Stanley and how that turned out. The time you were talking to Keith Richards and he said that God's going to spank him.
Yeah.
These are great stories, Ricky, and we are just so tickled that you took the time to be with us on the program today.
Well, I really appreciate it, Vic, and you did ask some great questions and some questions that no one else has asked. So thanks so much for a good interview, and glad you liked the book. And I hope all the listeners out there goes out and gets a copy, because it's really an amazing history of the music, certainly in our lifetime, you know, and I think people will really like it.
And in the last 30 seconds, I don't want to neglect to mention you've also got a new CD coming out, and you're going to be on tour.
Yeah, I just released a CD actually today with Bruce Hornsby. It's a live CD, and we're actually coming to the Taft Theater. I think it is the 4th of October. Let me look here really quick and see, but I think it is the 4th of October. Here we go, quick iPhone deal here. Yes, Cincinnati, the Taft Theater, Ricky Skaggs, Bruce Hornsby, Friday night at the Taft, and it's going to be a wild, awesome ride. It is so much fun to have him on stage with me and Kentucky Thunder playing bluegrass as fast as you can play, and him keeping up with us like there's nothing big here.
Back to Cincinnati where you got that gold jacket, right?
That's right. I might go down the street and see if I can find me another one.
Well, Ricky, thank you so much.
Thank you, Vic.
You've been listening to Book Nook on WYSO. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Jim Cobb was the lead attorney in the largest criminal case to come out of the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. We'll have his story next week. Flood of Lies, the St. Rita's Nursing Home tragedy. It's quite a story in the Book Nook. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.